Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we're revisiting a few folks who've been on KVC Arts before, though with two of those, conversations not yet heard on the program. We'll hear from pianist Vijay Iyer talking about, among other things, the new disc with his sextet, Far From Over, as well as his lecture and solo performance at University of Redlands January 17th. More on that at redlands.edu/events/Vijay Iyer. We'll also hear from Kitaro about a series of discs, Sacred Journey of Kukai. To begin, though, as Paul Anka revisits the area with dates in Palm Desert, January 12th and 13th, at Beverly Hills on the 14th, we'll revisit a recent interview with Anka and KVCR's Lillian Vasquez.
As a young kid, you liked Frank Sinatra, and later you would form a friendship and become a part of the Rat Pack that was Frank, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr. And you focus a lot of that in your book.
Yes, well, it was a turning point in my career because I'd started as this teen idol, and as things morphed, I tried to evaluate what I was doing and where I wanted to go with it. And I actually wound up in Vegas very young with Sophie Tucker in 1959. And, you know, for all of us, the epitome was the whole cool Rat Pack scene. For me, Bobby Darin, Mickey Avalon, we all kind of looked up to it, and Vegas was the entertainment capital. Beatles hadn't hit, heavy rock hadn't hit. Thus, we were really contemplating, you know, we can't keep this going, but we need to change. So I became a part of that stable.
As I was reading your book, you wanted to perform from a very early age, and Your mom was really your biggest cheerleader, and she died at a very early age. Did she get to see some of your success?
She did. She passed when I was 18. I knew that she was having a rough time. I brought her down from Canada. I bought her a home and made her a lot more comfortable because we really didn't come from an affluent background. And I wanted to give her as much of a life and let her see my success. She certainly saw it. You know, the more important thing was trying to, in some way, make things better and easier for her. I did everything I could, but unfortunately, diabetes was not treatable with what she had. So but she saw it, she sensed it, she felt it. I shared everything with her and for her because, like a lot of mothers, they're the core of every family. My dad worked very hard all day into late nights. She knew what I wanted, you know, at a time when pop music was in its infancy stage and no one was really listening to a young kid.
Thank goodness for moms that believe in their kids, right?
Oh, without question.
I know you've told the story so many times in your long career, but I'm going to ask you if you wouldn't mind sharing the origin of the song Diana.
Well, Diana, it's all in there. It's in that song. You know, I was 13, 14 years old, somewhere in there. This young girl, I guess, she was 3-4 years older than me. I saw in the community, at church, etc., caught my eye. You know, it's just that chemical thing. You know, I threw a line out there now and then, and she really wanted nothing to do with me. You know, boys, especially back then, were young and just flopping along. Girls are more sophisticated. After rejection and being thrown out of a shorthand class, which I didn't need anymore for my journal, I took up music. The first thing I wrote was this poem, Diana, I'm so young, you're so old, you know. Looked real silly when you looked at it. And then once I got music class and my piano started to happen, I wrote it for her and started playing it at parties, and she thought that was kind of cute. And she, in a sense, really acknowledged it, but not in any way that I wanted. Mm-hmm. Thus, it was just a song in my folio, and when I went to New York and recorded it, it was a hit. She became very interested, but I'd always been to France and Japan and met other girls, and it was
you'd
a
moved on, huh?
Frankly.
Do you remember the first time you heard it on the radio, and how did you feel the first time you heard that one?
I heard it the first time back in my hometown of Ottawa, Canada, because I was still living there, and when it came out, you know, back then records hit real quick. You knew within a week, so my hometown jumped all over it. It was all over the stations in Ottawa, and that was the first time that I heard it.
So I want to ask you, are you a singer that can write or a writer that can also sing?
That's interesting. Well, when I started, I think I was a writer that could sing his songs. I didn't have a great voice, a lot of passion. I mean, today, I'm more of a singer-performer who can write. But they're two separate entities. It's kind of a real different emotional existence. And writing has been very constant for me, and it's been the foundation of my success, frankly, to survive all these decades and have a bunch of teen hits and then write Tonight Show Theme and then Longest Day and then My Way and She's a Lady, etc. That really separated me from the pack. But I'm more the writer, but I'm still more the singer and entertainer, which is, you know, I don't have a job. I tell people that I don't do work, and I don't. You know, it's kind of...
It's a great job.
Passion. It's a passion now. It's like a love fest. I work, and I work when I want to work. I don't work 200 days a year like I did before. I do
Sure. Just
when and where I want to work. It's a passion as opposed to work.
I'm wondering if, you know, during the British invasion, Do you think because you had the talent of writing that helped your career to continue to grow because you had that skill as well?
Well, there's no question, you know, that skill of being a writer was the gravitas, and it really helped me survive. There's no question about it, because it just kept me in the forefront. You know, this kid writes the Tonight Show theme, then he gets nominated for an Academy Award at 21 for Longest Day. But the British invasion, from my point of view, really helped us.
Oh.
I met the Beatles prior to them coming here, and, you know, there was not a media-driven society back then. And I met them in France. I met them in London. I spent a lot of time with them. There was no CNN. There was no way that everyone in the United States knew who the hell they were. But I loved it, and I'd come home and tell my agents, this group, blah, 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 Beatles. And they'd say, what Beatles? Are you crazy? And it was my agent, Norman Weiss and Sid Bernstein, that flew over and signed them and brought them over to the Ed Sullivan Show. And I was very gung-ho on that because, you know, we weren't really accepted unilaterally with everyone. We had our fans, but
Sure. By
and large, with Presley and us, we were, you know, no one liked their music that was over a certain age. And what happened, there were several barriers, but with the Beatles, when they hit, it pretty much opened up the pop music industry to where it was embraced by everyone. Madison Avenue embraced it. You know, they were the core of all the commercials and everything that was sent out. So I liked it because it broadened it.
Oh, nice.
I kept writing, and I had hits. You know, I had top 20 records during that whole Beatle and the English invasion. I went to Italy. I sold millions of records over there, and I really had nothing to complain about, right?
Now, you wrote a piece of music that played on national television for 5 nights a week for 30 years, a theme from The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. How did that come about?
Well, kind of a little differently, but the same way as The Longest Day. I was doing a TV special, actually, and someone had sent me a kinescope because I was looking for a comedian. They sent me a film of this guy who drank all night, an hour of sleep, and got up and had this kiddie program. Kids screaming and yelling, and it was very funny. It was Johnny Carson. I said, God, that guy's great. So I flew him to England. He did it. Came back, ran into him again in New York. I said, what are you doing now? He said, oh, I don't know. I might do this television show for about a year. I said, oh, okay. He said, I need this. I'm changing this. I said, I might need a new theme song. Say that to a musician, and you got it in 10 minutes.
No.
So I went in the studio, put it all down, gave it to him, and went on the air. A year went to two went to four went to eight. You know the story.
Right.
And it lasted forever and longest running theme, and that's pretty much how I got it.
Wow, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing that with me. In 1967, you wrote the song My Way. So many artists have performed it, from Sinatra to Elvis. Who did you write it for? Who was My Way for?
Flat out Frank Sinatra.
Flat out?
Yeah, right from the get-go, it was for Frank Sinatra. I had real meaningful years with him after I met him in the early 60s, in 68, somewhere in there. He came to do a film in Florida, and I was working at the Fountain Blue, where we all used to work. And he called me and said, "Kid," that was my nickname, he said, "Kid, why don't you meet me for dinner? I want to tell you something." Anyway, I went to dinner in the course of the meal. He said, I'm quitting. I'm retiring from showbiz. I've had enough of this. You know, Rat Pack's over. I'm, you know, being hassled, etc." And I said, "Wow, you know, I mean, the impact of that." So I went home to New York, like around midnight. I started putting the words to this melody, and I had it done in like 5 hours, because I put him right on the typewriter. I just wrote it as if he were speaking. It was like an amazing creative moment that I was in. There's a big thunderstorm outside, banging on the windows. It was pretty wild. I finished it in 5 hours, and I called him at Caesar's Palace, where he was. And she comes home to his last gig. They bring it out, and I flew out, and the next night I was in his dressing room. I gave it to him, and he looked at me, and I knew the way he looked at me, he liked it. About 2 months later, I was in New York. I got a call from Sinatra in a record studio in L.A. The kid listened to this. He played it to me over the phone. I started to cry.
Mm-hmm. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yes, it is.
Now, I know you performed that song as well,
yep.
And so many others, Puppy Love, Diana, Lonely Boy. I mean, the list is so incredibly long. With so many songs in your repertoire, what are some of the favorites the audience can expect to hear, or do you keep it a secret?
There's a couple of surprises. There's a very moving piece I do with Sammy Davis with video and sing with him.
Oh, nice.
And it gets a little interesting on a few other things for the Buddy Holly piece.
Now, you traveled with Buddy Holly as a young kid, did you not?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. He was my seatmate. He sat right next to me. He gave me a guitar back then, taught it to me, and it doesn't matter anymore. His last big hit was written by me. I took the blows and did it my
way.
KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Paul Anka at the McCallum Theater in Palm Desert, January 12th and 13th, and in Beverly Hills on the 14th.
These digital ill-pixelated chips are sick. I find no rhythm in their paint. The celluloid that slipped through camera tips are relevant for satellites and quick immediate remedies. Chomping at the bits and pieces of our metered thoughts.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. We'll be closing the program tonight with Kitaro. We'll hear about his continuing series of discs, Sacred Journey of Kukai. First, though, we'll hear once again from Vijay Iyer, music from In What Language, Behind Us Now. Iyer's latest disc, or project as he refers to them, is with a sextet called Far From Over. And while touring the disc, he'll be lecturing and giving a solo performance at University of Redlands, January 17th. More at redlands.edu/events/Vijay Iyer.
In this position with the wrists cuffed.
With all these different projects, and again, addressing that term for a second, projects, it's so wonderful because we're not talking about these jazz discs. We put some of these things in a different category. In What Language, that's a great example about genre hopping. Those aren't my words, but it's a good example of saying these different sounds that appear. This is something that I love to see with your music. Some is bordering on straight ahead or kind of in this progressive jazz feel. I'm labeling it as we just talked about this. But what I want to get to is the fact that people hear different types of music, as it were. What do you suppose the common thread is, beyond just saying, well, me, on 88 keys? What is the common thread between these different sounds that you produce? When you're making music, but then it ends up falling into different categories for the listener anyway. You probably lecture on this Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
I mean, honestly, these categories, like I said, are fiction.
Okay, all right.
Really, where it starts for me is a certain set of possibilities. It just starts from a creative impulse, you know, and also an impulse to connect, to make contact. with another person. And then when you flesh out that process, like, okay, this time I'm making contact with a string quartet. Mm. And what do they do? What can we do together?
Right.
You know, they then are probably the kind of people who don't self-identify as improvisers. They wouldn't feel empowered to do that if I said, okay, we're going to play Giant Steps, and then we're going to play Take the A Train, and then Body and Soul. You know, that kind of thing. Like, you know, there's a certain set of people who I could say, that's what we're going to do, and then we'd make something from that standpoint. It'd be different every time.
Yeah, hopefully.
And everyone would put an individual stamp on it. And also, with those people who I would call creative musicians, if I replaced the drummer with a different person, a different drummer, then it would feel different. It would sound different.
Sure.
If I replaced bass player with another bass player, it would feel different and sound different. Different things would happen, you know? So that's kind of what it means to be in the community of musicians that I usually find myself in, right? Is that you have people who are empowered to make choices and leave their mark on the music in a way that's indelible, you know, and that's irreplaceable. Like, in the sense that if you replace them with someone else, it's not there anymore. It's somebody else's mark instead. So that's the kind of thing that we are accustomed to doing with any of those tunes I just mentioned, or any other, like a whole bunch of other tunes, right? You know, if I then said, you know, with a string quartet who are basically maybe trained in what's called Western classical music,
right?
It means that they have a certain set of skills that they bring to the table and a certain set of assumptions about what's there and what's not there.
Mm.
You know, like you work from what's on the page and you bring some thought process to what's on the page and you find a way to shape it and bring it to life. And there are some like typical ways that that happens. There are some atypical ways that that happens. But that's a kind of like very different set of possibilities there. You know?
Sure.
I couldn't just rattle off a bunch of standard tunes and tell them, okay, we're going to do this. They wouldn't be ready to do that.
Yeah.
I could present them with a bunch of notation and say, okay, let's find a way to play this. You know?
Okay.
Let's take some time and figure it out and find some strategies for working through this. And it might be an open process. I might say, okay, here's a bunch of notated stuff for you guys to play. Now, what I'd like you to do is actually treat it as not a fixed kind of linear thing, but actually just choose any measure at any moment and play it any way you want to play it. You know, something like that. Or I might say, okay, here's a bunch of measures. Now, you can repeat them any number of times individually, and you don't have to synchronize number of times with each other. Or I might give them a more relational process, like, you're going to play this, but you're going to keep changing tempo, but you have to do that together. So you tap into a skill that they already have, but ask them to do it in a way that they don't usually do it. Just enough that it feels satisfying when it arrives. Now, I want them to keep doing that, to keep changing. So that involves a certain kind of interaction that they already know how to do, but they don't usually use it in a more spontaneous way. You tap into what they're able to do.
Wow.
And you try to also reach beyond what you're able to do. We all just try to push ourselves in every situation. That's true whether it's Tirtha or my sextet or me playing solo or making music for a string quartet or me writing a violin concerto. It's always just treated as like, okay, I already know what I know how to do, so let's reach into something unknown. Let's reach into something that's outside of my limits. That's a challenge that's going to test me, that I have to rise to it, that I have to figure something out, solve some problems, and make some discoveries for myself. Then in doing so, what I should do is also some research. Like, how have other people done this? What are some other approaches to the same constraints, the same set of problems? Which might mean like consulting other composers, or reading scores, or listening to recordings, or going to a lot of concerts. Just enlarging your community. You know, that's basically what it comes down to. So now I find that I'm part of this community associated with this music called jazz, but I'm also part of the community associated with classical music and contemporary, or in so-called new music, as it's called.
So that's what they're called.
I love that title either.
Yeah, no, no, that's like world music.
Yes.
Non-Western, yes. <It's>...
So I guess that's how it works, is for me, it all involves me. It's true. So,
so
that,
that
is something
that
holds it all together. But it's also that it all involves basically a version of the same process, just with different starting conditions. That's basically it.
I'm so going to be listening to the discs that we have at the house with a different ear now, because just knowing that, like the kind of blue recordings, somebody else can go read the liner notes on that later, comparing it to a Japanese painting and this one take sort of thing. But it really feels like you certainly didn't walk in there and hand them sheet music. It's very stream of consciousness, almost, but there were parameters given. But then there's still freedom.
Are you speaking about Mutations in particular?
Gosh, I'm speaking of Tragicomic. I'm speaking of Panoptic Modes.
No, I mean, the thing is, like, when I'm working in the format that's more familiar to jazz people,
right.
Like,
yeah, yeah,
basically in a trio or a quartet or that kind of thing with bass and drums and maybe a horn player or two or three, then, yes, I'm tapping into the fact that they can all create, you know, but I'm also giving them maybe more detail than most people do.
Okay.
So, like, if you look at my scores,
okay,
for those things, like for the music on Reimagining or Tragicomic you mentioned, mm-hmm, or Blood Sutra,
yes,
and Optic Modes, or even the trio music in
Historicity, oh, yeah,
or Accelerando or Breakstuff, that all has more detail in it than you often find when someone says, like, here's a lead sheet for the standard or something like that, or here's my tune, it has a melody and some changes, you know. My stuff tends to be a little more carefully orchestrated. I write out parts for everybody, you know, for the drummer. Drummer has material that they're asked to play, you know, like specific rhythmic material specifically orchestrated on the drum set. Bassist has lines that are written out. I have parts written out for two hands, you know, it's not just G minor 7 for four bars.
Oh,
it's
good,
actually
good.
Like written maybe arpeggiative material or linear stuff or doubling
good.
Another instrument. So, you know, that's how it works for me, is that actually it might be just compact, like one or two pages of material, but it has these layers of information in it. And then we expand from that. So the improvising process is about unpacking what's on the page and bringing all those creative skills that we already have to that, you know?
Beautiful. To know about, since you'll be coming to University of Redlands, you know, I think that every time you play, even before this conversation, I felt like you would see it as an improvisation, but still with some guidance. Do you know yet what you'll be giving us with a solo performance at the University of Redlands and a talk as well? What do you have ahead of us? Or do you even know?
I feel pretty strongly that the musical experience, I don't want to say speaks for itself, because it doesn't speak. It does something else instead of speaking.
Sure.
You know, in the sense that it moves for itself, I guess I'll put it that way, or it acts for itself. And so it doesn't need to be validated or justified through other modes of discourse or something like that.
Mm.
And so I put a lot of care into, from the piano, constructing a set of experiences and, like I said, making contact.
Right.
With others, with everyone, hopefully everyone in the room. I have a range of repertoire that I've attempted, but I also am always trying to create something new and bring something else to the table that I haven't already. Because really, what I've found in the course, especially of doing solo performances, is that the most important thing is to allow yourself to be vulnerable in those moments. Because that's when a different resonance happens for everyone in the room, where you find an emotional place that we can all be at together, you know, where we might all find ourselves suddenly exhaling at the same time. You know, that happens,
yes,
in ways that you can't predict, and you kind of have to be open to that. So I do find that it's important not to plan it, but only because of that, you know, because
right,
you have to allow and accommodate those kinds of moments that you can't otherwise plan or account for.
Sure. Well, with that in mind, of course, you would want to have your own compositions or music that's very spontaneous and just starting off in this chord and just go from there. Or you start off with discord and go from there. But then do you ever think about or make sure to include either a jazz standard? Or I saw a nice take on Human Nature, for example, just to keep it familiar for the audience.
Like I said, I'm there to make contact, so it's not about, that's also not about repertoire.
Yeah, sure, okay.
You know, because just because you know a song doesn't mean that everyone in the room knows it. That's not actually how it works. It's not about assuming a familiarity and then like meeting that on those terms. That's not what happens in the course of performance. I play all over the world for all kinds of people, and I can't take for granted that everyone in the room even knows Human Nature. In fact, often what happens is I play Human Nature. Someone comes up to me and says, oh, that was great that you played that Cyndi Lauper song time after time. I said, it's not that song. Why do you think it's that song? Then I remembered that Miles Davis played both of those songs, and so they're confusing the two of them
right.
for that reason, which means that they're actually more familiar with Miles Davis than they are with either Michael Jackson or Cyndi Lauper, you know?
Or Steve
Picaro.
So that's
something that happens a lot. And, you know, I also find just working with my students, undergrads who were born in 98 or 99, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, they don't know what dub is. They don't know, who Carly Simon is.
Oh, gosh.
They've never heard a Bob Dylan song. They might never have listened to Stevie Wonder.
Oh, no. Oh,
they might just know what he looks like or something. You know, they might not even know a single song by A Tribe Called Quest.
Mm.
Or by Bruce Springsteen, or by Michael Jackson, for that matter, or Prince. They might not know any of that music. But they're on a whole other thing now. The world keeps turning, you know, so there's no actual common core of knowledge that we have anymore. And I find that we can't rely on that. So what we actually have to rely on is something more basic about how we listen to each other, when we're present, when we're in the same room, what is possible. It's at that level that I make contact with everybody. It's not at the level of repertoire or of familiarity or anything like that. It's at a human level.
At the Music in Conversation with Vijay Iyer, lecturing and performing at University Redlands January 17th. More at redlands.edu/events/Vijay Iyer. Later in the program, we'll hear from Kit Taro. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
We have to address, at least to a certain extent, far from over. We were just speaking of solo works or trios and chamber. In this case, it's a sextet. Please talk about the sextet. You've got Graham Haines. You have Roy Haines' son. And so, for me, that's exciting, but I guess for most people in the room, who's the guy on cornet? But tell me about your sextet and who these people are and how you gathered them for Far From Over.
Well, yeah, I mean, Graham Haines is someone I've admired and sort of idolized since the early 90s when I first heard him. And he made some of my favorite albums in the 90s when I was in my 20s and trying to figure it all out. And then when I moved to New York at the end of 98, not long after that, I met him through mutual friends. We had these opportunities to play together in other people's bands. And he was exactly that, like, wizard with time and space and sound and lyricism. And he was, like, an incredible listener, and he had this mastery, you know. And his time was super strong because, yes, he's Roy Haynes' son. He, like, grew up in that, you know. But I should also say that it doesn't matter if someone knows who he is or not, because he always delivers. And that's what makes these people great. It's not that you know that they're great. It's actually that they do something great every time. That's what it's really about.
Nice.
And it doesn't matter. Like, there's actually a video of us playing at this little tiny room in downtown New York called The Stone.
You and Graham.
Yeah, well, it's with a version of the sextet.
Oh, okay.
A few years back. And he was late because he had lost his flugelhorn.
Oh, no.
Thought he had left it on the train. So right before the gig was starting, he actually left to try to go find it. And he wound up, I don't know, he somehow found it. I don't know where it was. I think he left it at someone's house. And he came back at the end of the first tune. And he just got his horn out and he just started playing. Like, right, like he came in the door and started playing. It was really like that. So, initially it looks like it's just a quintet gig, and then he shows up out of nowhere, and he completely changes the atmosphere with the first sound. I mean, it's just like that. I mean, basically, no matter what the circumstances are, he conjures something mysterious and important. That's yes. what I adore about him and learn so much from him. Mm. So, yeah, I'm fortunate. It's an ongoing pleasure to continue working with him. We have a lot more performances throughout 2018 with this band. And so he's one. Steve Lehman, someone I first met actually also in 1999, because he was playing in Anthony Braxton's okay. band, and we were on the same festival in Italy. So I first met him there, and then I started hearing him around New York. And then I asked him to join a project I was in called Fieldwork, and so I've been working with him pretty constantly since 2003. Tyshawn Story is the drummer who just received a MacArthur Fellowship.
Ah, there's two of you now.
He's an incredible composer and visionary drummer, and I started working with him in the early 2000s as well. He's on the album Blood Sutra. He's on the third Fieldwork album, Door. He's on Rade Rade, the film score, and he's on the Sextet album. And wow. We've done a whole bunch of stuff together over the years. He often plays in the trio.
I have a question, if you would, Vijay, regarding Tyshawn Story. Tell me about the first time he came over to your apartment and this drummer sat down at the piano. Do you know what story I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Do you mind repeating
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's now sort of the stuff of legend, I think.
But, well, can we propagate that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember that he came over and brought his drums, and he took a really long time to set up the drums, so I left the room and just let him handle it himself, and he was not in any hurry or anything, and then I started hearing sounds on my piano. This was in probably 2001, and I had just released an album called Panoptic Modes.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I heard these sounds on the piano. I said, wait a second, I know this. That's me. Like, I realized he was playing something from that record. I mean, like, not one of the melodies or something composed, but actually just a little phrase of me improvising that he had captured and was playing with, you know. And then I heard him just do a bunch of other things. He was playing the Stockhausen Klavierstücke, one of the pieces,
yes.
and he started doing this kind of serialist improvisation and a bunch of like really wild stuff, and I realized this guy had a lot going on. So that was the beginning of something that continues to this day. I mean, we collaborate all the time. I feel blessed to have him in my life and in my circle and to be making music with him. He's one of the greatest ever, as far as I'm concerned.
You've got Stefan Crump again on the bass. He seems to be the person that I see on all of your discs, or a lot of them, I should say.
Well, we've worked together since I moved here also.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's been a blessing to have him in my circles, too. I mean, to have someone who brings a sort of lyricism and melodicism and simplicity and intensity and sense of space and sense of groove. He's a real artist himself. He's a composer, band leader. And then there's another saxophonist named Mark Shim, who's, to me, one of the great tenor saxophonists of today. I think he's pretty underrated. I see him as kind of the heir to people like Joe Henderson and Gary Thomas. He's got this incredible tone, and is very creative with sound, with lines, with ideas. He's a composer and brilliant band leader as well. He put out some albums on Blue Note in the late 90s, early 2000s, and played with Elvin Jones and with Betty Carter and Delphi Marsalis, I guess. A lot of other people. He's actually like a real bona fide. Like, he has all the cred from having worked with the legends, the masters. So it's great having that kind of wisdom in the group, too. And he's not so old. I mean, I think he's around 40, maybe.
Now, I'm truly going to wrap it up by suggesting that people look up something that I don't really have time to bring up, but I would have loved to have heard you speak of the model minority. Now we're stepping away from music, or staying with music, doing MIA, except with a piano and drums and a bass. So many things that we could bounce around, and again, it goes back to that horrible genre word. I know a person can find so many different sounds, as it were, when they listen to your music, so I want to just sort of leave it like this. What do you have in the works? This is almost a pat question as far as, after this tour, what are you recording? But after this tour, what are you recording? What do you have going now?
I guess the next
new
thing that I know is being recorded is I'm doing a duo tour with the pianist Craig Taborn, so we've been doing this two-piano improvisations for several years now. So we're going to play a few concerts in Europe, and I think one or two of them will be recorded, and we'll see where that goes. I continue to get invitations and commissions from people in so-called classical music, so-called contemporary or new music, or whatever you want to call it. Basically, these virtuosic soloist chamber ensembles and orchestras. So I'm writing a duo for myself and the violinist Jennifer Koh, who I've written a few other pieces for her. I'm also writing a piece for So Percussion. They're a quartet of virtuosic contemporary percussionists. And I guess I also have a commission from the LA Philharmonic. It's a new music commissioning kind of project, so they solicit works from contemporary composers. So that's
okay.
Something that I guess I have a year to write that piece, and I'll probably use all of it. I'm lucky to get to do what I do and keep pushing myself, keep learning, and collaborating with people and making contact.
We are very much looking forward to seeing you in Redlands. I look forward to speaking with you in person. And this is something that Priya and I developed, and it's because I, at one time, was a major Toto geek. And everything that we ever spoke about, it always came back to Toto somehow. So finally, now with you playing Human Nature, there is a one degree of separation between
you're right.
Toto.
Steve Porcaro is one of the songwriters.
That's right. Again, I look forward to seeing you and meeting you and experiencing this. I know we can't say, okay, this is what we'll get. And in a way, that's a nice way to leave it. We don't know what we'll get, but it's going to be guided and improvised and informative, and hopefully you will reach people. I know you will.
I'm looking forward to it.
Music from and conversation with Vijay Iyer, with a lecture and solo performance at University of Redlands January 17th. More at redlands.edu/events/Vijay Iyer. VIJAYIYER. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. For the remainder of the program now, it's Kitaro. I spoke to him recently when he was touring Kojiki and the Universe. And something we didn't get on the air last time, it's a wonderful series of discs, five so far, called Sacred Journey of Kukai. Now, like so much of Kitaro's recordings, it's music hoping to instill peace, and it's a series which started when his plane was diverted due to two other planes flying into the World Trade Center, September 11th, 2001.
It was a big surprise. It's, you know, I was in the air, and the announcement is like we are landing, but I saw the palm trees.
Yeah.
What is the Portland, Oregon doesn't have a palm trees.
No.
And that was Hawaii, Honolulu. And, oh, no, this is something wrong. And then I was in the first row. I was sitting in the first row. And then doors opened, and then three soldiers came in with M16.
Oh.
Yeah. It was a bit, it shocked. I shocked. Wow, what's happened? It's something happened. And then I asked the custom officers, what's happened? She said nothing. But it's finally, I tried to ask her almost like 10 to 20 minutes. And then finally she said World Trade Center had attack. And I, wait, because of my friend's company inside of the World Trade Centers. So it's totally destroyed. So, yeah, that was a start to happening.
So this is the beginning of what became a five-disc series. Did you start composing immediately, or was this when you started to retrace the visits of Kukai? And actually, first, Kitaro, we should probably address first who Kukai was and the significance with these recordings.
Yeah, the Kukai. Before that, I had the TV series up in Japanese national TV, NHK.
Mm-hmm.
They had kind of the sacred journey of the Kukai. He is a well-known monk, almost like 1,300 years ago. And after 9/11 happened, I immediately fly back to Japan. I try to think about, okay, what I can do for the world peace. Then I started the recording of the temple bells, each one. Each temple has different size of the bell. So I'm trying to go there, but I took 10 years finishing the bell sounds. They have 88 temple bells.
Mm.
So 88 temple bells with each song. I try to add the song with the bell. Now I finish until the 49, which is the five albums. So 88, maybe another four albums.
So as Kukai, some 1,300 years ago, traveled to these various temples as he was speaking, did you go to all of the temples that he did? Did you truly retrace his steps?
Yes, I did it, which is almost like a 1,200 miles.
Yeah.
Some people take a walk for pilgrim, and some people take, you know, the cars. But the old days, everybody took a walk.
Talk to me about the process then. You recorded these bells in these various temples. And so as you were layering these albums together, these five so far, did you lay down the bells first and play around them, or did you produce recordings that the bells could then fit into? Because they do fit in perfectly as they are, so it's again a chicken or the egg, which came first?
Well, first of all, in the beginning is the bell sounds first. We're recording the bell sounds and then bring back to the studio, and then because we need to check the bell's tuning.
Oh,
but it's the bell itself not exactly tuned. It's like many of overtones. So we try to matching the bell sounds and music. It's very tough decisions. Okay, this key is A flat 20 cents,
yeah,
something.
Right.
You know, it's not exactly the key.
It just wouldn't be, I suppose.
Yes, but we did it. We tried to find out the key. That's one of the big steps. Then, each temple, I got many of photos and some videos I still have, you know, that try to remember each temple's kind of impressions. When I went to the temples, then create the music and create the bell. You know, it's kind of stories of each temples.
As we're going track by track in the series, something that we often hear is the water lapping at the edge of a shore. Is this signifying literally landing on another shore as you're about to visit another area, another temple?
Right. These 88 temples within the one big islands. So it's almost like near the shores and then going to the mountains, and then down to the waterfront, and then going up to the another mountains. You know, the more nature's sounds.
You truly do have the feel of travel as you're going through this. And now we talked about a bit of process as far as recording, but now how about the process of writing for each disc? Because they each have such a flow. They each have a beginning and a crescendo, and then bringing a person back down gently. It would not surprise me if you told me that the tunes were recorded in the order that we hear them. It seems like you felt what you needed and then did that before moving on.
Yes, because each temple has a theme. So we felt it. And it's based on more spiritual and peaceful things. Even the recording, too, is like a bell sounds. We have 8 channels of recording.
Mm.
So that was a really high-quality sound. But during the copy to the CD, we cannot use that technologies. So that toward the end of the recording of the bell, we back to 96K recording process.
The first one in the series came out of a time of a desperate need for peace. As you were going through the albums, were you truly more at peace yourself as you went through these recordings? Did it work for you as well?
Yes, trying to becoming more deeper and deeper.
Nice.
So I hope
another four albums I'd like to finish next 4 or 5 years.
One
because,
year.
Because I took too long, and then the many of the temples at the monks tried to ask me about, when you finish the Maya temples? Wait, maybe next year. Yeah.
This is a wonderful series of albums, and it could be complete as it was. And I suppose some people may have thought that it was complete at four discs, but I'm excited that there may be more coming out. Did you have in mind, by the way, a certain number? Did you know that it was going to be five discs when you started this? Or was it initially going to be solidly four? What was your original intention with this series? Because the first one states,
well,
this is a series.
That was hard to decide because I'm like touring, I'm doing at another project, so I need to take my time for Sacred Journey of Kukai, 6, 7, 8, 9, or something like this. But I'm sure if I have a time, I'm going into the Sacred Journey of Kukai, another 4. I like to finish as soon as possible.
I'm curious how you would even know when you're finished with something like that. It's such an organic, felt-out, intuitive kind of process for this series.
Yes, and I'm still using the recording to the tape.
Oh.
It's old technologies, but it sounds better.
That's music from In Conversation with Kitaro. We've been speaking primarily about Sacred Journey of Kukai, a series of discs which started with the events of September 11th, 2001, and continues to this day. That's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Kitaro, and for setting up the interview, Gail Rosenberg, and a very special thanks to Domo Music Group at domomusicgroup.com. Thanks to Paul Anka in Palm Desert, January 12th and 13th, in Beverly Hills on the 14th. Thanks to Vijay Iyer at University of Redlands, January 17th. Once again, more at redlands.edu/events/Vijay Iyer. Thanks also to Dr. Priya Jha at University of Redlands for coordinating the concert. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Jessica Greenwell, and KVCR Interim General Manager Keith Bergfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.